You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
These days, when we don't know something, or are curious about something, or looking for a specific article, video, or website, we're likely to check into a search engine. But it turns out that the searches we type into, most of them have another function. They can be used to study our behaviors. In his book called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Reveals About Who We Really Are, New York Times correspondent and data specialist Seth Stevens-Davidowitz reveals how big data know who we really are. It's published by Day Street, and I'm very pleased to welcome Seth Stevens-Davidowitz to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
When did we start using the term big data?
I'd have to look at the Google searches to figure that out, but I think it was only about a few years ago.
How was big data collected in the past?
Data in the past tended to be surveys, right? If you wanted to know what people were doing, you'd ask them. Or what people wanted, why people did the things they did, what they're going to do, you conducted a survey. But now there are new sources of data, which is just the trails that everybody leaves as they go through life.
And you say surveys are not always the best way to really find out what's going on.
Exactly. So people lie to surveys. If you ask people, are you going to vote in an election before an election, or you ask people immediately after an election, did you vote? A huge percentage of Americans lie. They say they voted or will vote.
But sociologists and psychologists also have been interested in collecting data. Do they have better systems? Better approaches?
I think they haven't really had a system better than asking people. They've tried a whole bunch of stuff, but it didn't really work. But they didn't have the internet for most of the history of these fields.
And computers really help us collect and interpret things.
Exactly. And there are certain sources such as Google searches where people are more honest than they've really ever been to, as far as I can tell, anybody in history. People tell Google things that they don't tell to friends, family members, themselves even.
When you say they tell it, they're searching for information. Now, someone like me who uses Google and other search engines to help prepare for guests for interviews must really confuse Google because I'm all over the place.
I think the data is not perfect. I talk a lot about health in the book, and definitely most of the searches for symptoms are from patients suffering from those symptoms, but some are from researchers or doctors. So it's not perfect, but it is pretty accurate on average.
How does someone become a data specialist these days?
I kind of just invented the job for myself. I did my PhD in economics.
And then you worked for Google for a while?
I worked for Google for a while, yeah.
And what were you doing there?
I was doing a lot of some advertising analysis and similar stuff.
Weren't you a quantitative analyst?
Yeah, I think that was my official title. It's kind of just building models to try to figure out what people are going to do.
And why did you leave?
I wanted to write this book. I signed the book contract. I wanted to work on that full time.
Do all of the search engines, Bing, Quora, Dogpile, collect data in the same way?
They all, to some degree, do. I think Google's is more organized because they've been collecting it for a longer period of time.
Don't a few, like DuckDuckGo and Ixquick, offer more privacy?
I think the data I use is anonymous and aggregate, so I don't think it's a big privacy issue. But there are services that erase your searches as soon as you put them in the computer.
Getting back to the surveys, you say there are three reasons people lie on surveys, which of course then makes them unreliable. What are the reasons?
Well, I think one of them is you don't have an incentive to tell the truth. So there's kind of no reason for you to ever be honest on a survey. So people lean in the direction of making themselves look good. I think another reason is people are in a habit of lying. So you tell your partner that he or she looks great, or the meal is great, or things that aren't always true, and those behaviors carry over to surveys. And then also people lie to themselves a lot. So if they're if you're lying to yourself, you can't be honest to a survey.
And aren't there some people who are more likely to even respond to a survey than others?
Yeah. Survey response rates are now below 10%. So it's getting – I think surveys are getting worse and worse. There's also an increasing number of people who mess with surveys, particularly teenagers.
Just have fun.
They did a study of the connection between adoption and negative behaviors such as drinking alcohol, and they found a large correlation that teenagers who were adopted drank more alcohol, and they did a follow-up study and they found that it was totally unreliable because a large percentage, more than half of the teenagers who said they were adopted, weren't really adopted. They just thought it was humorous to tell a survey that they were adopted.
What's a social desirability bias?
That's the general idea of why you can't trust surveys, that people try to make themselves look good. So they say that they exercise more than they do, or that they vote more than they do.
Unless they're teenagers.
Unless they're teenagers, in which they say they're adopted or they're 8 foot tall or have a one leg. That's a popular answer among teenagers. But yeah, but for older people. Generally just give a socially acceptable answer rather than the true answer.
So getting back to Google, you say it can be used to collect and analyze data on people's real preferences. Their searches are more reliable than surveys. That means forget about me, but when somebody is using it, are you aware that it's one person?
No, so the data is all anonymous and aggregate. You just know the total number of searches, although they do eliminate data if it's the same person making the same search over and over again.
But as I understand it, one of the reasons for collecting this data is to direct ads to people. So you have to know that it's me and not the next person if you're sending a certain kind of ad.
Yeah, so internally they may know that, but externally for the research, it's all anonymized and aggregated.
So it's not just for – they're not using it just strictly for advertising purposes?
Well, I think at some point they realized how powerful the data was for research purposes, and they made it available to researchers.
And what information do you get from analyzing people's Google searches?
Basically, the world doesn't work how I thought it worked. I've kind of found that over and over again. So one example I talk about in the book is racism, how much racism there is in the United States. Even though if you ask people in a survey, are you racist, the overwhelming majority of Americans, 98-99% of Americans say, of course not, I'm not racist. Like, how could you ask such a ridiculous question? But in the privacy of their own home, Americans make racist searches with shocking frequency.
And what is a racist search like?
Well, I can't use the language on NPR, you can imagine, think of jokes humiliating African Americans. That's the most prominent theme of racist searches is humor mocking black people. And one of the things that was really surprising to me was not just how frequent these searches were made, but they were made in parts of the country that I wouldn't have guessed. So I would have thought before I had started this research that racism would be predominantly concentrated in the Deep South. If you think of our country's history, we usually think of the racism divide as a South versus North divide. And it definitely is high among the places with among the highest racist search rates include Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama. But right up there with them is Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio, Industrial Michigan, Upstate New York. The real divide of racism these days is not North versus South, it's East versus West.
Although perhaps it's also a matter of quality. The other day, it was reported that a Mississippi legislator suggested that we lynch anyone who tries to take down one of the Confederacy monuments. Lynching is, I'm assuming, is part of is one of the ways that you discover somebody is a race.
Well, I think that's kind of an extreme racism and I think in many parts of the South, there's more openness with racism where you can say a statement like that and not realize that you shouldn't. But I think many parts of the North have just as much racism and it affects their behaviors just as much, but they're not going to say it out loud.
Didn't racist searches increase after President Obama's speech about rejecting discrimination in lieu of the shooting in San Bernardino?
Yeah, so one of the things you see with this Google search data, you can break it down minute by minute. and you can see how people are responding to external events. And again, this is kind of the main theme of my book, I guess Everybody Lies, that basically you can't trust the things we've traditionally thought. So I talk about in the book about this speech that Obama gave to quell Islamophobia after the San Bernardino attack. And it was a beautiful, moving speech that got rave reviews. But if you track the minute-by-minute searches, just about everything Obama did made them more and more angry.
My guest is Seth Stevens Davidowitz. His book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. What can collecting these racist tendencies help us understand?
Well, I think, so the first step is just that these attitudes exist in larger numbers than we probably thought, and they predict a lot of behavior, whether it's opposition to Barack Obama or support for Donald Trump. These racist searches correlate very, very strongly.
So they tell us about, they can predict voting patterns?
And explain voting patterns, but I think that's not the most interesting use of this data. I think the more exciting use of this data is to learn how to change attitudes.
Well, since this data was collected, then why did so many people predict Donald Trump would lose the election?
Well, I said he'd win, so I think that does suggest once more how you can't trust surveys. That a lot of people said they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but then actually voted for Donald Trump.
What did you find when you analyzed racist patterns throughout the United States by using search histories?
Well, that basically you're going to be able to predict a lot of behaviors. And I think one of the things, there's this big paradox in America, and this has been a huge theme of sociologists and psychologists, which is if you do studies on how African Americans are treated and how white people are treated, just about every study shows that there's racism, discrimination against black people. So in jury decisions or in police stops or in many, many other areas of life or in voting, Americans still show a preference for white people relative to black people, employment decisions, all kinds of areas.
Does this cut across party affiliation?
Yeah, across party affiliation. But the paradox is if you ask Caucasian Americans, if you ask white Americans, are you racist, just about everyone says no. So the answer historically for the last 20 years, the predominant answer has been that this thing called implicit bias, that you, me, everybody listening on the radio, all of us have some subconscious discrimination and prejudice towards African Americans. So even if we're not consciously aware of it, we will be discriminatory. I think what some of this research suggests, these racist searches, is that explicit racism that people hide because it's socially unacceptable may be playing a bigger role in discrimination. There's nothing implicit about the searches I was studying.
So if I were searching for information about a white supremacist group, it probably would not suggest that I was a white supremacist unless I just kept on going at it or I didn't write the book that search would have suggested I was researching?
I think not everybody. It could be the most, and people can read the book to find the actual searches I'm talking about, which are pretty vile and not necessarily searches one would make for a research reason. But some, the most vile search in the world, you don't know for sure why someone made that search. I certainly, when I was researching this book, made a lot of horrible searches. Just for research purposes, but this is a small percentage of searches, and it gets washed out in the data.
People have been calling in with questions. A listener asks if he has multiple users at home using the internet on different devices. Is the data aggregated?
Yeah, so it's aggregated at the city level or time level. So we don't know for sure what any individual is doing. We just know what lots of people are doing.
And later we're going to talk about employment, but a listener saw a recent ad for a Google search cleaning service so prospective employers can't see your searches. How public is the data, really? Can employers access your searches that easily?
The employers can't access, employers cannot access your Google search history. So that, I think, is a myth. I think people are a little paranoid about what employers know about them. I think social media data employers can use because it's all public. So you definitely want to be careful there. But employers can't use your Google search history.
Well, even though it's on a company computer?
Oh, if you're working at a particular company, then they can see what you're doing at the company's computer. But that's different. They can't see the past searches you made when they're deciding whether to hire you.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz, his book Everybody Lies has a foreword by Steven Pinker, subtitled Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. It is published by Day Street, and we'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Seth Stevens Davidowitz. His book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. It's published by Day Street. You mentioned earlier that we can learn an awful lot about health by looking at what people write into search engines. Don't doctors hate it when you come to them after you have kind of researched yourself and come up with a diagnosis of what's wrong with you?
Well, I think one thing we can do with this data is learn things that even doctors don't know. So I talk about a study in the book about pancreatic cancer, and this was by researchers at Columbia and Microsoft. They studied the same users, anonymous and de-identified, over time. And some of the users, they could tell, just got a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. Because when people get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, they search something like, just diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, what do I do? And then they studied their searches in the months leading up to that diagnosis, the symptoms that they had searched.
This is Microsoft doing it off their Bing
search engine. Yeah, Bing search data. And they found really, really subtle patterns to the point that if you have indigestion followed by abdominal pain, that's a risk factor in pancreatic cancer.
But
if you have indigestion alone, that's not a risk factor. And that's a subtle pattern that even doctors didn't know. And it's only available thanks to the huge numbers of data points that Microsoft could mine.
Would it be ethically acceptable for Microsoft, Bing, or Google to suggest to people who are searching certain symptoms that they may have pancreatic cancer?
I think, yeah, that's kind of a big question. For me personally, I would want to know that. Maybe you should have an opt-in that you should say that, you know, if you don't want to be told about potential diseases you have, you don't have to be told. But if you want to be, you can be told, because pancreatic cancer, the earlier you are told, the higher your survival rate goes.
You spend a lot of time talking about sexuality in this book. What did you find out looking at Google searches concerning sexuality?
That
you can say on the air that the FCC isn't going to get upset about.
I don't know the exact rules of the FCC, but I'll try my best.
I think it's seven words you can't say. That's pretty much it.
Okay. So there are lots of things in the data. So one of the studies I do is with homosexuality. And this probably isn't so surprising, but if you compare where people say they're gay, there are way more openly gay people in California than Mississippi, in places where it's easy to be gay than places where it's hard to be gay. But if you see gay porn searches, they're almost the same everywhere. So the gay men in Mississippi, they exist. They're just in the closet. I think that's kind of the first step. It's probably not so shocking. But then you find that a lot of people have desires that we didn't even know about. Sexuality gets pretty strange. I don't like using that word, but
they're looking up things that their loved ones may be shocked to know they're interested in.
Yeah, in big numbers, like the mainstream things that people search, in pornography, is I think pretty shocking. Like the common searches, the common desires, not even just fringe stuff.
And how can we use that? Why does it even matter if somebody has satisfies kinky thoughts by looking up, watching certain things on their computer rather than acting them out on them.
Well, I think, I don't know that there's a huge use case except curiosity. Like, I think sexuality has always been an interest to a lot of people, so it is interesting to learn the truth about these areas. But, I don't think there's anything wrong with people having whatever desire they have.
What did you find when you started analyzing the English language?
So one of the things that I talk about in the book a lot is that data has changed. We used to think of data as, you know, with a survey which people take, it's kind of a checkbox, right? Yes, no, numbers. It's very, very structured. And now data is much more unstructured, including the words that people use. That's now a big source of data.
And it turns out that men and women use different linguistics?
Yeah, so you can compare using all the Facebook posts, so what words men and women use more, and some of them are definitely not surprising. Men, one of the words most disproportionately used by men are football and Xbox. Probably not gonna shock anybody. But one of the things I found kind of interesting is that among the most disproportionately used words by men are a whole bunch of curse words, which surprised me because I grew up around a lot of women who freely threw around F-bombs and stuff, but that's actually a male trait, cursing.
And what are the words that women are most likely to use?
So with two O's, like so, and then so with three O's, like so, and then so with like four O's, so. The more O's, the more likely it's a woman in the so.
Men are not...
They don't add O's to their so's, yeah.
How do you analyze how searches relate to unemployment rates?
Yeah, well, this is a study. I was looking at whether you can predict the unemployment rate based on the searches people make. And I assumed if listeners want to guess at home what would be the searches most correlate with the unemployment rate, what I would have guessed is unemployment benefits or new jobs or unemployment help, unemployment assistance. But the single search most highly correlated was, I think, a word that I can't use on NPR, but was a pornographic site, which is kind of makes sense that when people are not out of work, they're basically looking at more porn. So that's the highest correlation with the unemployment rate.
During times of high unemployment, are searches such as unemployment job search typically?
Yeah, they are searched, but not as much as the porn searches.
So they just have time on their hands.
Yeah, exactly. Solitaire is also something they search a lot in the PG realm when they have when they're unemployed.
So they're playing solitaire on their computer.
Yeah.
Kill time.
Yeah.
When Netflix asked its members what they would want to watch in the future, what did they say?
Yeah, this kind of goes to the theme of the book, everybody lies, that you can't trust what people say, and this is true in business as well. Netflix initially asked its users what movies they wanted to watch in the future. So right now they were watching this movie, but what do you want to see this coming Saturday or this coming Sunday? And when you ask people that question, they tend to say very highbrow films. They talk about, they say they're going to want to watch the 16th century Russian documentary or the clever new French film. And then Saturday comes around, Netflix showed them all these videos, and they all ignored them and went back to the same lowbrow comedies or romance flicks that they'd always watched. So Netflix kind of realized you have to just ignore what people tell you and just build algorithms to predict what they're actually going to see.
On the other hand, those algorithms often are wrong for me. They say, you may also want to watch such and such, and no, I don't want to watch those.
They're not perfect, but they're probably better than your own predictions of what you're going to see, which also are highly imperfect.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz, his book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are, is published by Day Street. Can we use social media sites such as Facebook to analyze data about people?
I think we can, and there are some interesting findings. I talk about in the book how you can predict what makes people like a baseball team or what causes people to have certain political views when they're adults or buy certain products. But I think we have to be really, really careful with Facebook because, if people lie to surveys, and they do, they lie way more to Facebook because they have an incentive to look good to their friends rather than tell the truth.
So Facebook posts and shares are actually revealing what we want people to think about us?
Yeah, so I call Google searches digital truth serum, and then Facebook posts are digital brag to my friends about how good my life is serum, that people just exaggerate how intellectual they are, exaggerate how happy they are, exaggerate how good their relationships are, exaggerate how rich they are, basically exaggerate everything to impress their friends.
The same sort of thing that they might say to a dating website.
Yeah, yeah, that's another notoriously unreliable source of data.
Did you use any Facebook data for this book?
Yeah, I did. I did a bunch of studies with it, but I tried to do it in areas where people wouldn't necessarily be embarrassed.
So how is Facebook using the information people disclose on their page as well as in their posts and likes?
Well, one thing that all these companies do that some people aren't aware of is called A/B testing, and that is that you can do a small experiment, a small controlled experiment. You put some people into a control group, some people into a treatment group, and you show them different versions of the site. So one group may get a different font or a different color or a different text.
And font and color matter?
They do. They sometimes can matter enormously. And then the data scientists at Facebook or any of these companies basically analyze which one gets people to click more or stay on Facebook longer. And because they're all using computers, it's all automated, they can do these really, really fast. Facebook does more experiments in a single day than the FDA does in an entire year. And then this is one of the reasons that some of these sites have gotten so addictive, that they just keep on doing these tests, finding which one wins and changing the site to make it more and more powerful.
And do we know what kinds of fonts appeal more? Is it serif or sans serif fonts?
One of the things you learn is that there's not a general lesson. You want to be careful. One of the reasons experimentation has proven so valuable to businesses is that there aren't really general lessons. You just have to keep trying different things. And some things work for a while and stop working. Some things work under certain conditions and not others. But you keep on testing, you find the best combinations.
In social media, people tend to surround themselves with others who have similar views. Does that apply to when they're going online as well?
Well, there's a myth that the online world is segregating us, is creating these filter bubbles where liberals hang out only with liberals, conservatives only with conservatives. It is true that online you tend to surround yourself with people who share your political views. But that's true offline, too. And in fact, it's true even more offline, that people have friends who share their political views, coworkers who share their political views, dinner party companions who share their political views. It turns out you're actually more likely to come across somebody with opposing views online rather than offline.
It sounds to me like a lot of the things that we discover when we collect all this data is that not only are people more complicated than we would like to believe, but they're also more screwed up sometimes than we would like to believe.
I think that's right. I think a lot of people ask me, how has it changed me to spend 5 years analyzing the darkest and weirdest thoughts that human beings have, namely the Google searches that people make? And there have been parts that have been depressing and really disturbing, and I've researched child abuse and do-it-yourself abortions, people in real trouble in life. And that is, you know, that's really hard and you know, can make me really depressed. But I think there's also this part where you learn of people's anxieties and insecurities and struggles. And that's actually, I think, made me kind of happier because I feel less alone. You're constantly bombarded with lies about how easy other people find life. So there's something comforting in finding you're not alone in your vulnerability.
No, you're at the New York Times now. You used to be at Google.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you apply what you learned at Google to your job at the New York Times?
A lot of it is data analysis, data journalism. So I use the same tools that I was using at Google, but to try to tell stories that people find interesting about who we are.
Now, can't some of this data be used against us? For example, aren't banks using data to decide who or who shouldn't get a loan?
Yeah. So the study I talk about is a study of peer-to-peer lending on this site Prosper. And to get a loan on Prosper, you apply. You say why you need that loan. And data scientists found out you can predict whether someone will pay back the loan based on the words they use in that loan application. And some of them
just
are
just the words. What kinds of words?
Some of them are bizarre. If you say "I promise," you're way less likely to pay back, which goes to the point that everybody lies. Like, that's one of the biggest indicators. I'm not going to pay back if you say I promise. And one of them that is maybe even stranger is if you use the word God, you're much less likely to pay back, much more likely to default, about 2.2 times more likely to default if you include God in the loan application. So someone would basically make money by not giving a loan to anybody who said, God bless you, or, you know, I swear to God, or anything like that. And that's kind of disturbing because there are perfectly honest people who just, unwittingly put say this without realizing that the algorithms are grouping them in with people who are less reliable.
I wonder how psychologists would interpret all of that, the word promise or using God.
I think it's interesting. There are kind of two parts to data. There's predictive analytics. So Google and Facebook and a lot of these companies are much more interested in prediction than explanation. They tend not to care why things correlate. They just know that things correlate and can make more money knowing these correlations. But then social scientists and psychologists and sociologists are more interested in the why question. So yeah, what does it tell us about society that people who mention God or people who mention a relative, that's another one. If you mention a brother or a sister, a mother or father in a loan application, you're much less likely to pay back. You know, my brother's in the hospital, less likely to pay back.
But as you point out, that can also be discriminatory because somebody who would be willing to pay back the loan, would probably pay back the loan, might use those words and be rejected not understand why.
If you think about the current legal framework, for most of the last century, really, companies have known 5 to 10 things about a person. They may know the person's race, they may know the person's address, they may know the person's income or net worth or home ownership. And then the laws are there to we have laws in place to say which of these factors can a company consider. They can't consider race, they can't consider religion, they can consider home ownership or income or these factors. But now we're living in a world where companies know a million things about you. They know the words you use. They know the things you like on Facebook. They know all your social media activity ever. They know maybe things you've clicked on. They know so much about you. And I think the ethical and legal system is not really prepared for big data.
Can't companies also manipulate Google? They have found ways to get their thing at the top of the Google search?
It's kind of a constant battle between Google and companies to get to the top. But in general, Google tends to win that because they have really, really good engineers who make certain that people get the sites they want. There are actually complications to this. And talk about the darkness of the world. For a while, when people made searches about suicide, looking for information about suicide, obviously a really, really dark, disturbing topic. And actually, you can predict when suicides are high when people are making a lot of these searches. So a lot of people do go through with it. I mean, it's really disturbing. But for a while, when people made these searches, among the top returns were message boards with people saying, like, you should kill yourself, or like, here's how to do it. Like, really, really nasty, dark stuff that the web has kind of unleashed. And Google had a policy of not messing around with the results, that it was all an algorithm. But in this case, they realized they couldn't just let the algorithm show people who are thinking about suicide these nasty comments from crazy people on message boards saying to do it. So they changed the algorithm to make sure that people
do it. It's like saying jump if somebody is.
Exactly. So, I mean, they're just crazy people. For whatever reason, the formula, a lot of people are clicking on this. And for whatever reason, Google's algorithms had this near the top. And they realized this is insane. We have to have right at the top suicide hotlines and information from professionals to stop people from doing this.
A listener called in to say that he'd noted a recent study that people who purchased or searched for birdseed were also more reliable when paying back loans.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah. So
birdseed of all things.
Of all things. So that's one of the strangest things about big data, that like the correlation between anything is almost never 0.00000, right? Everything you do has some correlation with something else you do. So there are all these strange correlations that people who like curly fries tend to be more intelligent, or people who search birdseed payback loans. They're out there.
Just one more thing. Does this mean that we no longer are going to even bother relying on polls or surveys?
I don't think polls are going out of business. I think they're just going to take a smaller and smaller they're going to make a smaller part, much smaller part of how we explain the world.
My guest, Seth Stevens Davidowitz, is a New York Times op-ed contributor, a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School, and former Google data scientist. He has written a book called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. It has a foreword by Steven Pinker, and it is published by Day Street. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.